Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming. I think we're ready to get started. And my name is Josh Hartshorn. I'm this year's president of the Student Legal Forum. And this is our second event of the year, and I'm glad that you're all here. And without further ado, I'm going to let Professor Lillian Bevere introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Josh. I'm very happy to see all of you here. One of the most wonderful things about the wonderful job that I have is to observe what our graduates make of themselves after they leave the university. They flourish, and they really do, and we take great pride in them. We marvel at them. Several years ago, we were having a conversation in the faculty about a student request for some curricular addition or another. I've actually forgotten what it was that the students thought they had to have. And the students made an argument, which of course seemed plausible on its face, that after all, they were the consumers of legal education, and therefore it was our job as the providers of legal education to give them what they wanted. And I had a colleague at the time, now please none of you take offense at this, who said, No. You don't understand. You are not the consumers of legal education. You are the product. And that is precisely what you are. You are the product of this law school. And therefore, what our job is as a law school is to make the highest quality product we can out of you. Now, if you think about it this way, and you think that the consumers of the product that you will become are people that need legal services, and indeed in the long run is the legal system itself. When you think about it this way, it is our job to train you as well as we can and to make sure that you are a high quality product. And from that point of view, I'd like to tell you with some great assurance that our speaker today is, he's one of our Cadillacs. So we're very proud of that. He's going to talk about the Duke Lacrosse case, as I know that you know, a case that brought to the fore so many social currents that it's quite impossible for him to even think about talking about all of them in the span of one short time, and he is smart enough to know not to try to do that. He's going to concentrate on the legal risks that the indictments that Mr. Nifong brought posed for his client. As you know, Jim is a criminal defense lawyer. His job is to defend people accused of crime, whether they are innocent or guilty. The Duke case reminds us, though, that criminal defense lawyers have another and much more important, or at least equally important, job from the individual client's point of view. I'm sure it's not much more important, but they have another important job, which, if they do that job well, and Jim does it well, helps to secure the lives and liberties of all of us. And that job is to protect the legal system itself, the criminal justice system, from the kind of prosecutorial abuse that Mr. Nifong was guilty of. Robert Jackson, who served not only as a Supreme Court justice, but also prosecutor in chief at Nuremberg, had this to say about prosecutors in general, and I think it's a good time to remind ourselves of this message. The prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. While the prosecutor at his best is one of the most beneficent forces in society, when he acts from malice or other base motives, he is one of the worst. The citizen's safety lies in the prosecutor who tempers zeal with human kindness, who seeks truth and not victims, and who serves the law and not factional purposes, and who approaches his task with humility. Well, when you don't have such a prosecutor to ensure your safety, all you can do is hope that what you have is a criminal defense lawyer like Jim Cooney. Please welcome him.
I appreciate that introduction, unworthy as I am of it. Can everyone hear me? Any problems back there? I'm not a big fan of podia. For those of you who are going to do trial work, don't ever stand behind the podium because it separates you from the jury. And you never want to be separate from the jury. You always want to be able to look at and talk to them and really communicate with them. And that's just what I've gotten used to over the years. I'm going to be talking about the Duke Lacrosse case, but before I begin, I want to say a couple of things about that night and what led to what we all know and call the Duke Lacrosse case. That night began with colossal bad judgment on the part of these lacrosse players. I know them all. They're all good young men who did a really stupid thing that night. I don't know in what parallel universe they thought calling an escort service to hire two strippers was a good idea. But they did. Reed Seligman, my client, wasn't one of the ones who organized the party. But he certainly went. And he was at a party he shouldn't have been at for about 10 minutes. These players, the captains who organized it, the players who were there have apologized for it repeatedly. As well they should. But by the same token, if we're going to take every 22-year-old male who's done something equally stupid and lock them up, that's probably going to be about 80% of our college population. Now, as a father of college-age daughters, that's not such a bad idea. But it's a practical matter. None of us ever want to be defined or held to the dumbest thing we ever did. Not a single one of us. Unfortunately for these young men, and for my client in particular, who before this had been an honor student for 2 years at Duke, and whose only run-in with the law had been a parking ticket up in Morristown, New Jersey, the proportionality for what happened that night for that bad judgment would offend even the Eighth Amendment's definition of cruel and unusual punishment. Because within a month, my client was the most reviled person in the country. His picture was on the cover of Newsweek magazine as not only a rapist, but a rapist who participated in a gang rape that was motivated for racial purposes. And ladies and gentlemen, what we know about this situation is it was a hoax. Now, we've had lots of people in this country who were innocent and convicted of crimes, but this is one of the first times I can recall where innocent people were charged with a crime that never occurred. In a homicide case, you've got a body. You know there's been a crime. In this case, there was no crime to begin with. And you don't have to take my word for it. What you can do is you can look at the evidence and listen to what the people who investigated the case said. Let me begin with this picture. It may be a little hard to see. It's of the false accuser. Her name is Crystal Langer. And this is a picture of her, you can hardly see it, outside 610 North Buchanan. She's right there. At about 12:25 a.m., which is about 25 minutes after she said she'd been gang raped for a half an hour by three Division I athletes. And when you enlarge that picture and take a look at her, takes her head up here, and again, the lighting's not so great here. She's laughing, holding her purse, hoping they haven't shaved it. The boys had locked her out of the house. They were trying to get her to go away. She was trying to get back into the house where she later told people she'd been raped. The city of Durham, in a memo on May 11th, said this: "Let me acknowledge the city's concurrence with Attorney General Roy Cooper's decision to dismiss all of the charges against Evans, Seligman, and Finnerty, as well as his declaration that these young men are innocent of the charges for which they were indicted." The Attorney General of North Carolina issued a report, a summary of conclusions. I'd like to review a few of those with you very quickly. He first said that the reinvestigation that they did concluded there was no credible evidence to support the allegation that the crimes occurred. He went on to say that because of the lack of evidence and the other proof they found, the two special attorney generals believed it was in the best interest of justice to declare these three individuals innocent of these charges. They not only dismissed the charges, but they said they were innocent. And some of the reasons the attorney general highlighted were that her testimony regarding the alleged assault would have been contradicted by their evidence in the case. that her testimony regarding the assault and the events leading up to it would have been contradicted by her own prior stories in the case. That there was no testimony or physical evidence to corroborate her testimony whatsoever. That the accused individuals were identified through questionable photographic procedures. That credible and verifiable evidence demonstrated that the accused could not have participated in the attack at the time she said it occurred. And her credibility was suspect based on her prior encounters with the police, her medical history, and inconsistencies within her own statement. He talked about a few of those. This is my favorite, or one of them. When she shown pictures that contradicted what she said, for example, she contended she danced in a bedroom. They showed her pictures showing her dancing in the living room. She said, Duke must have paid somebody to alter the picture. And we'll see those pictures a little bit later. In addition, when she was asked why she was so certain of her ability to identify her attackers, she claimed she was good at remembering faces. When the special prosecutors brought Officer Gwen Sutton of the Durham Police Department into the interviewing room, the accusing witness claimed that she did not know Sutton and had not seen her before that day. Officer Sutton had spent more than 5 hours with the accusing witness during the early morning hours of March 14, 2006, as the officer who began the investigation into these charges. When the special prosecutors asked her about her behavior, because all of the young men agreed that she was impaired that night, she claimed she was dizzy when she was dancing, she was dizzy after the assault, she was dizzy in the bathroom, but she woke up in time to be able to identify everybody before she got dizzy. This is not cooperative. Finally, the Attorney General acknowledged what we all have to acknowledge. Trauma victims sometimes don't remember everything accurately the first time. But this wasn't a situation where she said the shirt was light and yellow later, or he was wearing blue jeans instead of black jeans. She was changing, as we're going to see in a second, major elements of what was going on in every version she told. And in fact, this accusing witness never told the same story twice. Detective Ben Heine was the lead investigator for the Durham Police Department, and after he was shown some of the evidence I'm going to show you today, his deposition was taken in May. And he was asked, did you, by the time the criminal charges were dismissed, did you come to any conclusion yourself about whether you thought Ms. Mangan was sexually assaulted on March 13th and 14th at 6:10 p.m.? And his response was, I came to the conclusion that she had made up, that she was not telling the truth about anything, that she was improvising everything that she had said. That everything she was contradicted with, she would make up improvisation of what actually happened, of why this happened, why this didn't happen. The lead investigator who was responsible for securing the indictments that could have put these young men in jail for 30 years now says no crime occurred. Well, how does that happen? I got into the case later than some of the other lawyers. I was asked about a year ago to take over Reed Seligman's defense, and so I was playing catch-up for most of the month of October and November. And the only way I could keep up with what was going on is I had to put together a checklist. And the particular checklist I put together was based on 3 statements that she gave. She gave a statement in the hospital on March 14th, she gave a statement on March 16th to the investigators, and then she did a handwritten statement on April 4th, as well as going through an identification procedure on April 6th. And her story was basically this, that she was attacked by 3 men named Matt, Brett, and Adam, and they performed various things on her. And what I tried to do is keep up from story to story, who did what to whom and when. And so I began on March 14th, 2006, and what she said at that time was that Matt made her perform oral sex. Matt made her perform vaginal sex, and that Matt claimed he was getting married at that. Adam performed anal sex on her, and Brett did nothing other than assist. Then on March 16, 2006, when she talked to the major case investigators from the Durham Police Department, Matt is the one who made her perform anal sex. Brett also performed anal sex on her. And vaginal sex, and Adam made her perform oral sex, and apparently nobody was getting married at that time. Then on April 6, 2006, Matt is making her perform anal and vaginal sex. Brett makes her perform anal sex and vaginal sex. Adam makes her perform oral sex, and now this time Adam is getting it. So I'm looking at these three statements trying to figure out what's going on. And I decided to try to figure out who's who. And they indicted three guys named Reed, Colin, and Dave. Alright, who's Matt right now? And so to do that, I went to her statements once again. And what she said on April 4th and April 6th gave us some insight into who she thought was who. On April 4th, in her handwritten statement, she claimed Reed Seligman was the one who made her commit oral sex. And that Colin Finnerty was the second one who had raped her, anally and vaginally. And when you match that up on April 6th with what she says, she writes that Adam made her commit oral sex. And that Brett is the second one who raped her, anally and vaginally. So, seems fairly logical to me at that time. Reed Seligman must be Adam. Colin Finnerty must be Brett. And by process of elimination, Dave Evans is Matt. One little problem with that. When you read her written statement on April 6th, what she says is that she heard Nikki, who's the other dancer, on the other side of the door. And when Adam opened the door, Nikki rushed in and helped Adam to get deep breaths. Now that should have given them pause right at the end. Because I've handled a lot of rape cases. I don't know too many rapists after the gang rape who stop and help the victim get dressed. Passing over that. The stripper comes in, Adam helps to get her dressed, and then they dragged her out to the car because her legs were moving. So, what we know is Adam and Nikki take her out to the car, which means Reed Seligman has got to be one of the guys who took her out to the car. This is a picture of her being put into the car. Reed Seligman is not there. In fact, there is electronic evidence that Reed Seligman is 6 miles away in his dorm room. And she's being put into the car that we'll take a look at later. 20 minutes before she's put into the car, Reed Seligman is at an ATM withdrawing money. It's 2 miles away from where she says she was there. So, on December 21st, what Mr. Nikon does is he sends his investigator out to re-interview Ms. Mangum for the first time in this case, really since the indictment has been issued. Now, for those of you who have gone to criminal law, you're going to notice that whenever a major interview is done, the cops travel in pairs, or the FBI agents, or the Secret Service. And they do that for a reason, because they always want a third person there to be able to say what's going on or what happened during the interview, so they know misunderstandings. In this case, Mr. Nikon sent his investigator out by himself and didn't notify the police investigators that he was going. And on December 21st, these are his notes of who Adam Brett met. And of course, I defy anyone to figure out who Adam Brett met, because this is literally what he wrote. But what she said on December 21st, according to his written report, is that Dave Evans was, in fact, Adam, Dan, Brett, and Matt. So he was four different people. Reed Seligman was Matt and Adam. And Colin Finnerty had no name. That gave him the flexibility to say that whoever it was who did whatever could be anyone. The problem is, when you put it together, she claims Dave Evans performs anal, vaginal, and oral sex on her as Adam, Dan, Brett, and Matt. And Reed Seligman is Matt Adam, who doesn't have any sex with her. And Colin Finnerty, who has no name, has anal and vaginal sex with her. So we take these stories and we put them together, and where does it bring us? Well, when you take a look at the checklist and take these stories, what we know is that Brett penetrated her anally and vaginally, according to her. And Adam performs the sex act in her face. We know that Brett finishes at the same time as Adam. Remember, Reed Seligman performs no sex on her, according to the latest story. So what that has to mean is that on December 21st, when she finds Dave Evans does a sex act in her face, and Dave Evans is both Brett and Adam, then Dave Evans has to be having sex with her behind and in front of her at the same time, which is where those stories get you. Now, I'm a street crimes kind of person. That's how I learned how to do criminal law. And one of the basic things in street crimes is opportunity. Did my client have the opportunity to commit a crime? If my client didn't have an opportunity to commit a crime, doesn't make any difference if he's the worst guy in the world or she's the worst person in the world, they could not have committed the crime. So one of the first things we did was we took a look at opportunity in this case. And the opportunity in this case involved 20 to 30 minutes. And what I mean by that is this. When she was interviewed by the police, and those are the police notes on the left, she claimed it took a half an hour for this rape to occur. These three young men beat her and raped her for a half an hour. And in fact, the police put that in a search warrant affidavit. The victim reported that she was sexually assaulted for an approximate 30-minute time period by three men. So it seems to me it's a fairly easy situation. You take a look at the time period and you look for a 30-minute period where Dave Evans and Reed Seligman and Colin Finnerty are together and alone with this young woman. And that's what we try to do. And the time period we're looking at goes from 11 p.m. on March 13th to 1 a.m. on March 14th. Now, all of you in here, a different generation than I am, you people travel in an electronic net. I've never seen a generation that leaves so many footprints behind you. And as you move through time and space, you're texting, you're making cell phone calls, you're getting emails and responding to them, and you can basically track your movements all over the place, which makes alibis very simple in the electronic age. And that's what we did. We gathered up the electronic data because we know how young people move through this society. And what we found is that at 11:11, 11:22, 11:25, 11:33, and 11:36, Ms. Mangan made five different calls from her cell phone. One of them was 7 minutes long, from 11:25 to 11:32, and it was to her home telephone number. We'll see why that becomes important later. Presumably, she's not being raped, and she's talking on the cell phone. So we begin to narrow the time frame. And those are her cell phone calls. We know that from 11:50 to 11:52, Reed Seligman is talking on the cell phone with his girlfriend, Mark Jandl, who's actually in Charlotte that night because it's spring break the next day. And of course, those are their cell phone records, and you can see that the numbers match up exactly the way they're supposed to. At midnight, there's a man named Jason Dizzy. Now, Jason Dizzy lived next door to the house where some of these are prostitutes. And I can assure you, Jason Dizzy was no fan of the guys who lived in that house. They kept him up a lot. And in fact, that night, he was watching what they were doing. He had to write a letter to the police because the police never came to interview him. And in the letter he wrote to the police, which he did on March 31st, he talked about seeing the women actually go into the house at 6:10, and after a moment, I remember quite specifically noting that it was midnight. So he has the two women going into the house at midnight. Again, as we narrow down this time frame. What we also know is that from 12:06 a.m. to 12:14 a.m., about 6 or 7 minutes later, Reed Seligman makes 8 cell phone calls, mostly to his girlfriend Brooke, who has fallen asleep, left her cell phone on vibrate, and is not picking up, so he gets a voicemail, turns it off, and calls again. The last call he makes is to a cab at 12:14 a.m. And that cab is operated by a guy named Moez Al-Mustafa, who's a legal immigrant of this country. And in fact, when we compare Reed's cell phone records, we see the last of these calls that are taking place from 12:05 to 12:14 is to that number, and Mr. Mustafa's cell phone records, which are that number, show Reed's call from his number. And in fact, the police went out and actually interviewed Mr. Mustafa. And he said, yeah, I remember getting the call. And I picked up both Reed and another player named Rob Bell. He said it took me approximately 5 minutes to get there after the call, so I picked him up roughly around 11:19. What did that get Mr. Mustafa? Got him arrested. The police went out, talked to him, got a safety plan. And then Mr. Nikon's office dug up a 3-year-old shoplifting. So they arrested him when he wouldn't change his story. And they prosecuted him for aiding and abetting shoplifting, which is, frankly, a crime I've never heard of in North Carolina, on the theory that a person who he was giving a ride to in his cab had gone into the store and shoplifted something and come back out, and therefore he was aiding and abetting the crime. Even though the person who did the shoplifting said he didn't know anything about it. So they put him in jail when he refused to change his story, and then they prosecuted him. That's a picture from his trial. These two officers here, Ben Hyman and Officer and Investigator Clayton, are two of the people that were investigating the Duke of Cross case and wanted to change the story. They didn't have anything to do with the shoplifting case. But they made sure they were in court, sitting 2 feet away from him, trying to stare him down, to let him know what they wanted him to do. And out of all of the people in the case, it's somewhat ironic that the one who acted the way we expect our citizens to act was a legal immigrant who had everything to lose and nothing to gain, but he knew what the truth was and wasn't going to back in. But in Durham, telling the truth gets you arrested. What we also know is at 12:24, Reed, of course, is at that ATM. And those are the ATM pictures. There are 15 of them. Every ATM has a camera. You go to an ATM, you're going to get your patient report. It's easy to recover. There's a videotape of him walking up, getting his money, and leaving. So again, moving through time and space, we can track it. And then we know at 12:46, Reed re-enters his dorm room. And we know that because he's got an electronic dorm card reader, probably like many of you had in college. And it shows that Reed is re-entering at 12:46. Between 12:24 and 12:46, according to Mr. Al-Mustafa, they went to cookouts, got more food than he had ever seen in his life, and smelled up his cat for the next 3 weeks. So he remembered these young men specifically. We also know at 12:22 a.m., Colin Finnerty is on his cell phone making his first call. At 12:24, he makes another call. At 12:26, Ms. Mangan makes a call on her cell phone. Who does she call if she's been gang raped? That number is the number for her escort service. That's the number she calls to see if there are any more jobs for her that evening. And then from 12:30 and 12:33, Colin Finnerty calls Domino's Pizza to make an order and then to cancel it. And you can see his cell phone records. And then finally we know that Dave Evans is on his cell phone at 11:29. And then from 12:34 to 12:50, for that 16-minute period. So what we have here, just based on the digital work, is we don't have a 20 or 30 minute period where these three kids were even together, let alone together and alone with Ms. Manning. In fact, we don't have a 10 minute period or even a 5 minute period where these kids are together and alone with her. But that's not the only record we have. Of course, this is Dave Evans' cell phone records. We also have pictures. Now, for those of you with digital cameras, you know that when you take a picture, the computer records something we call metadata. Dave Evans had a camera that he hadn't even pulled out of the box yet. And unknown to him, one of the other lacrosse players broke open his camera that night to take a couple of pictures. And later, when the Durham police came by on March 16th, they seized the camera. It was item number 14. The problem is they never looked at the pictures close enough. Because if they had, they would have found this picture. I told you it's not their finest moment. But as I was saying, when you take a digital image like that, you get something called metadata. And for those of you who haven't encountered metadata, you will, because it's all over the electronic discovery rules. But the metadata is what you get when you right-click on the digital image. And the metadata can tell you when the picture is taken. And it really can't be altered. The problem in this case is when we looked at that picture and we looked at the metadata, I'm sure the police did the same thing, it says it was taken on Monday, March 13th at 10:09 a.m. Well, we know that wasn't true because the party took place in the evening. So why is it altered? Well, again, Dave Evans had just bought the camera, had never used it. It was still on its factory settings. So the question is, what does that time really represent? And for that, we went back to the picture. And when you take a real hard look at this picture, any CSI buffs in here, what do you see that could help us? And when we enlarge the watch, 11:10. Then you can do this. 13 hours difference. Which meant that when we take a look at the pictures he has of the women dancing, we know there's going to be 13 hours between the metadata and when the picture is actually taken, because we've got independent corroboration. And in this case, you see the women dancing, the metadata says that was taken at 11:02 a.m. when we add 13 hours to that. March 14th, 2006, 12:02, which was corroborated by another camera that was there, being operated by a player named Kevin Coleman. The police knew about Kevin Coleman on March 16th when we interviewed the captains. And in fact, Dave Evans specifically told them that Kevin Coleman had a camera and pictures of her. And Matt Zash also told the police that Kevin Coleman had pictures of the girl. The police department never asked for Kevin Coleman's camera. They never executed any search for that camera. They never asked for the digital images or the metadata for that camera. Mr. Nyquan never asked for those images. What those images showed was that there were a number of pictures taken between 11:02 and 11:08. They showed the picture we looked at 11:09, between 11:09 and 11:10, that was taken by Dave Evans' camera. And then from midnight to 12:04, there were a total of 8 pictures of these women, 7 on Mr. Coleman's camera and 1 on Mr. Evans' camera. So now we're able to track them literally from 11:09 to 12:46. Because at 12:10, there's another picture taken by Mr. Coleman of the party room, and the women aren't there. And between 12:30 and 12:38, there are 6 pictures taken by Mr. Coleman of Ms. Manning. And then at 12:41, there's a picture that Mr. Coleman takes of Ms. Manning, who's leaving, which you've seen before. So now when we add the photographic record to the objective digital record, where's 30 minutes? Where are these three kids together with her alone for 30 minutes, or 20 minutes, or 10 minutes, or 5 minutes? The they don't go in until midnight, reads on his phone at 12:06, and they're dancing until 12:05. There isn't even 2 minutes for these three young men together and alone. There's a picture of them leaving, and you can see the metadata for both of those pictures, one at 12:03:58, one at 12:31:32. What does Mr. Nyquam try to do? Well, he and Mr. Wilson, his investigator, tried to change time. And what they did is they took this timeline and they tried to move everything back. On December 21st, when Mr. Wilson is investigating her by himself, she suddenly tells a different story. And what she says is that she got to the house at 11:10. And then from 11:10 to roughly 11:25, she's dancing. She goes out to the car, and about 11:25, she's dragged from her car and dragged into the house. So the rape can begin at 11:30. Now remember, this call she's making between 11:25 and 11:32 is to her home. One would think that she might tell somebody in her home she's been dragged from a car into a gang rape during that period of time. And then she claims the rape ends at midnight, even though Mr. Bissey is watching them and says they don't even go into the house today. The problem with this is if you're going to try to frame somebody, you need to learn to talk. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Nyquam hadn't bothered to check Ms. Mangum's cell phone records. So they didn't know about those calls. And as they tried to push the crime back to deal with what they did know about Reed Seligman's alibi, they ran directly into the objective digital evidence about Ms. May. The special prosecutors went one step further. Ms. Mangum was portrayed as a struggling college student who was struggling to pay her way to school. I suppose, like every struggling college student, she had not one but two drivers. She had lost her license 4 years earlier when she tried to run over a sheriff's deputy with the car she had stolen. And so her escort service provided her with two different drivers. Her driver that evening was a young man named Brian Taylor, and he told police he had dropped her off and then had gone to a Handy Hugo's that's a few blocks away from the house. Now, the police had never bothered to follow up to see what time he got to Handy Hugo's. You can see this is the receipt he used because he bought some Gatorade. And there's his signature. And when the special prosecutors followed up, what they found is that he didn't get to Handy Hugo's until 11:43, 23:40 in military time. Which means Ms. Mangum didn't even arrive at that house until roughly 11:40. So according to the receipt, Ms. Mangum doesn't even get to the house then when she claims she's in the middle of a gang rape. When confronted with this, Investigator Hyman testified under oath. What was your reaction when you saw the substance of the statements made in Linwood Wilson's investigative report in the December 21st interview? When I actually saw the report, I was reading it and I said it didn't make any sense. She had changed her story completely. And there was the sexual position she had. The suspects weren't even close to what she had told them. They had it underneath them and everything like that, and it didn't. It wasn't making any sense. I'm going to talk a little bit about the DNA. This is really what broke the case open for us. I'm going to teach you in 90 seconds everything I know about DNA. One of the things I have a real problem with on making phone calls is not only do you have to get all the numbers correct, you've got to get them correct in the right order. Otherwise, you get the wrong number. And DNA is kind of the same way. I want you to think of DNA as a 16-digit phone number because we're looking at 16 different places on the DNA strand at 16 different alleles to find what the order of the proteins are. And then to see if that order matches up sequentially with whoever's DNA you're looking at. So if your reference sample is 1, 2, 3, 4 through 16, Ideally, if you can get a 16 allele match, you'll have the same numbers in the same place, and you'll know that the chances are 1 in 100 billion it's not that person. That's pretty rare. Oftentimes what you get is this. This will be the reference sample you get from the suspect, but the DNA you'll find is only a partial DNA. It's only a partial profile that you can generate. And the profile might only have 5 of them. Now, in this particular case, you can see that the alleles match up where they're supposed to. 16 is where 16 is supposed to be, 3 and 4 is where 3 and 4 is supposed to be. So if you got something like this in this case, and this was your suspect, you'd say, all right, here's what my suspect's DNA is. Here's the DNA at the crime scene. We can't exclude my client as a contributor to the DNA. Doesn't mean it's him. Just means we can't exclude him. Now, sometimes you get a partial profile. Let's say someone wrong. And this is 16, but it's in place where 5 is. That becomes critical because that excludes this person as a contributor for that DNA. It excludes them with 100% certainty. You may never know who that person is, but sometimes the most important part about DNA is who the person is. And in this kind of a case, you would say that is 100% exclusion. This guy didn't do this. And that's kind of what we were dealing with in the different clause case. We had a lot of partial profiles floating around in the DNA. And in fact, these are the 7 pages that cost Mr. Nifong his license. These are the 7 pages that were discovered by a young attorney named Brad Vann, who's a graduate of the Campbell Law School. And essentially what happened is that Dave Evans had a partial DNA match that I'll talk about later on some fingerprints that were found in his bathroom. Of course, to me, finding DNA in your own bathroom is like finding fingerprints in your own house. It's really not that inculpatory. But Brad was concerned about it, and none of our client's DNA was on anything. So we basically said to Brad, all right, you're the DNA guy for this case. We're going to go off and do motions. You do the DNA. And Mr. Nifong handed him a CD with about 3,000 pages of data on it. And so he sat down and he did what I would expect a good young lawyer to do. He read a book about DNA so he could understand it. And then he started tracking all the evidence samples. What we do is we do these large charts so we know where it's collected, how it's processed, who reported on it, what happened to it after it was reported. And as he was doing one of those longitudinal charts, he noticed that the private laboratory that was doing this had found a bunch of DNA we didn't know about. The report that we were given was essentially none of our client's DNA were found in her or on her. That some DNA found in her was consistent with her boyfriend. In fact, it was a 16 allele match. So we're standing back fat and happy saying, well, this is great. You can't perform, you shouldn't be able to perform a gang rape and not leave any DNA behind. But Mr. Nifong's response was, wait a second. The absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. In other words, as he kept saying, you can rob a bank and not leave a fingerprint. And essentially implying there were no fingerprints to be found in this case. Well, what Brad uncovered was the fact that there were fingerprints all over the vault in this case. And none of them were the cross. And that becomes important for this reason. And let me give you a quick example. They found the DNA of 3 unidentified men in her mouth. Now, the mouth is a highly hostile environment for DNA to last a long time because it's very acidic. That's how we digest our food. To find unidentified male DNA from 3 different men in a person's mouth and then claim that the people who gang raped her orally didn't leave any DNA behind almost approaches the point of absurdity. It does when you consider one other aspect. We know the DNA didn't match any of these people. And in fact, each of these red numbers on this chart that we put together represents an unknown male DNA that was found on this name or in her that was not any of the cross players or any of our clients who were aboard her. And you can see the different fractions in the oral swab. But this particular result was the one that really caught our eye. And remember, we had not been given a report on any of this. It was a pubic cone. And for those of you who unfortunately have to deal with rape victims or do rape cases, one of the things they do is say, well, do pubic cones, because they're looking for unidentified hairs. Now, the DNA has gotten so sensitive that you can actually lift DNA off the cone. In this case, they were doing YSTR, Y chromosome testing. And that becomes important because that's the male chromosome. And it's important because everyone who processed this case until the end, the people who collected the swabs, the people who packaged the swabs, were all women. They don't have a Y chromosome. That's why they're superior to being. But what this particular test is looking for is DNA on the Y chromosome, and therefore there was no contamination during the collection process because only women were involved in the collection process. Until the end. Those are the two different male, unidentified male DNA they found at this particular location, the BDYS456. And as we were reading this, of course, it said that, no, this DNA doesn't match any of the lacrosse players. But then we saw this notation. Could be DNA. And Brad and I kept scratching our heads saying, what is that? Could be DNA. Black man. What could it be? And finally, Brad said, you know, the director of this lab is named Ryan Dean. Let me tell you how sensitive this testing is. When they process this testing, Dr. Meehan is practically wearing a spacesuit. He's gloved, he's gowned, he's got a mask, he may even have a visor if he's smart, he's certainly got something on his head, because he's concerned about contaminating the sample. He's the only Y chromosome that was involved in the process. And this testing is so sensitive, he always posts his own DNA profile just in case a fleck of skin, a piece of dander, somehow gets in the processor and he contaminates the sample. So what, in fact, we discovered was that Dr. Meehan had more DNA in this rape kit than anyone on the Duke lacrosse team. And that illustrated our point beautifully. Because there is no scientific way three men not using condoms could have raped this woman for 30 minutes and not left behind a single skin cell while Dr. Meehan, dressed up in a spacesuit, accidentally contaminated the sample. How does that happen? I want to talk a little bit about the identification process. The identification process, primarily because it may have, for those of you who are taking criminal procedure or are dealing or struggling with that, it may have some interest. It also illustrated the lengths the police were willing to go to on this. Under General Order 4077 of the General Police Department, there are certain requirements that the police are required to follow. And basically, they have to use an independent administrator. They have to use a minimum of 5 fillers per suspect. The fillers must resemble the description of the suspect. When showing a new suspect, you never reuse a filler. The administrators are to give identical instructions on each photographic identification procedure. You don't ever get witness feedback about you're doing good or you're emotional or something like that. And you always tell the witness that the suspect may not be in these photographs. Because you don't tell them that the studies show that they have a tendency to pick out a person in the array who looks most like the person they think of acting. In this case, there were a series of photo arrays done. On March 16, 2006, she was shown this picture of Reed Seligman in a photo array. And what she said at that time was that she was 70% sure she had seen him at the party, but couldn't remember exactly what he was doing. Now, presumably, if he was raping her, she ought to remember what he was doing. So as a defense attorney, I would take that to be completely exculpatory. You've identified it. You say he's not one of the attackers. You should never show her that picture again. It doesn't work that way. This is a picture of Dave Evans that she was shown on March 21st, 2006. And she basically was shown this picture twice, and she couldn't recognize him at all. And finally, on March 16th, 2006, and on March 21st, 2006, she was never shown Colin Finnerty's picture at all because he didn't match any of the descriptions that she'd given. And if you've met Colin Finnerty, you know why. He's 6'7" with red hair. He kind of stands out in the crowd. I mean, when you meet Colin, you've got to kind of go like that. And she never described any of her attackers as being 6'7" or tall or having red hair. So he was never even included in the original photo arrays. Well, by March 31st, 2006, the investigation was at an absolute dead end. Because she had looked at the pictures of 36 lacrosse players and couldn't identify them. And Durham was on the verge of burnout. There were protests that we'll talk about a little bit later. The African American community was upset, as well they should have been, given what Mr. Nachtong was saying. The faculty of Duke could turn on the students. I mean, there were serious problems in Durham, and they had an investigation going nowhere while Mr. Nachtong was comforting to the world that a rape had occurred, and he was going to find out if it did. So on March 31st, he instructed Investigator Hyman and Sergeant Gottlieb to do a procedure in which she would be shown all of the pictures of the Duke lacrosse players, and only pictures of the Duke lacrosse players, even though 36 of them she'd seen before. At that point, he also knew that there was no semen and that the testing from the DNA lab at the State Bureau of Investigation wasn't going to give him any results. And the other day, he said the whole thing was a crock. So on April 4th, 2006, they do what we call the PowerPoint identification. They claim there wasn't even an identification process now. But what they essentially did was, what they said at the time was, have a witness identify which of the individuals she recalls as being at the party. And they excluded the single African American player. When they did it, of course, Devin Sherwood was at the party, and they had his picture. Even though they now claim they were looking for witnesses, for some reason they never decided to interview Devin Sherwood to see what he saw, to find out what he knew. So, what they did is, they also knew, and this is something that the media never reported on, there were two white non-lacrosse players at the party. One was Blake Bowman, who they actually talked to 2 days earlier. And they knew he was at the party, and then Brent Sally, who they talked to a little bit later, they knew he was at the party. Yet they didn't include either of their pictures in the photo array because they weren't interested in having anyone except lacrosse players identify as perpetrators in this. They videotaped this particular photographic identification process, even though they claimed it wasn't an identification process. And the identification process they did claim had gone on the photo array, they didn't videotape it all because that was unsuccessful. Now, when she was shown Reed's picture, of course, she said she couldn't remember exactly what he was doing at the party, but she was 70% sure. So she'd already identified Reed as a witness, but the investigators never followed up to interview him. They never asked to speak with him specifically. And why don't you show her a picture of another person that she's already identified as being at the party? I mean, that violates every precept of identification. She was then shown this picture of Reed on April 4th, 2006. And suddenly, when it's being openly videotaped, in other words, they put a video camera right in front of her to let her know how important this was going to be. There were four investigators with her, and that had never happened. Remember, an independent administrator is supposed to do this, somebody who doesn't know anything about the investigation. There was no independent administrator done. There were no fillers being used. And she was told that she was going to see everyone who they believed was departed. Remember, you're supposed to tell that if we're not sure if the suspect is in here, he may not be in here. She's told just the opposite. Everyone who sees the suspect, pick who you want. And of course, she was also given feedback when she identifies them. When she identifies them, they say, all right, how certain are you? What were they doing? Again, violating the fundamental precepts of the way in which an identification is supposed to take place. So when she's shown Reed Seligman, she says, he looks like one of the guys who assaulted me. How sure of that are you? Oh, 100% sure. And then she describes what he did. On December 21st, when she talked about Seligman, she said he didn't do anything. Even though during the identification process, she claimed he raped her. You can see that she claimed on December 21st they were trying to get Seligman to do it, but he kept saying no, which was the exact opposite of what she said during the identification process. So on March 16th, she's 70% sure he's at the party, but doesn't know exactly what he's doing. On April 4th, she's 100% sure he's the one who made the formal sex. And on December 21st, he refuses to have sex with her and with somebody else who made the formal sex. She was shown this picture of Dave Evans on the 21st. Since we discussed, she didn't recognize him, even though she was shown this picture twice. But on April 4th, what she says is, he looks like one of the guys who assaulted me, sort of. How sure of you are on this image? Victim. He looks just like him without the mustache. Okay, so the person had a mustache? Victim. Yes. Percentage-wise, what's the likelihood that this is one of the gentlemen who saw him? Victim, about 90%. Well, this is a picture of Dave Evans on March 12th. And this is a picture of Dave Evans on March 14th. He never had a mustache. Yeah. What did they do about that on December 21st? When Mr. Wilson goes to interview him? Investigator Wilson asked Crystal Mangum to describe the mustache on Dave Evans. Crystal Mangum stated, it wasn't a real mustache like yours. It was like stubble or shadow. Investigator Wilson said, like a 5 o'clock shadow? Crystal Mangum said, yes, like that. So suddenly the mustache then becomes a 5 o'clock shadow. Notwithstanding the fact the picture of Dave that they showed had a 5 o'clock shadow. So on the 16th, she doesn't recognize Dave. On April 4th, it looks just like him without the mustache. And on December 21st, he had 5 o'clock shadow, really didn't have a mustache at all. And then, of course, on March 16th and March 21st, they never showed her Collins' picture. He didn't resemble any of the descriptions. And on April 4th, they're shown his picture. And she tears up when she sees it. Describes what he does. Says that he used his penis to penetrate her and imagine. And then during Mr. Wilson's interview on December 21st, she says, well, I can't really be sure penis was used. Which is what led Mr. Nikon to dismiss the rape charges the next day, but keep the sex offense and the kidnapping charges. So on March 21st and March 16th, Henry doesn't match any of the descriptions. Suddenly on April 4th, he's the second one. And then on December 21st, she can't even remember really what happened. But the story about this identification process is, who else should identify? On April 4th, she was shown this picture and said, he looks like Brett, one of the guys who attacked me, but I'm not sure. And who's Brett? One of the guys that assaulted me. So he looks like one of the guys that assaulted you. Yeah. Three people assaulted her. On that day, she identified four people as the attackers. He was never indicted because he's from Durham. And that didn't fit with the narrative. They wanted this to be out of town. They couldn't indict someone from Durham, so they went, they blew right by that guy and waited for her to identify three other people. And in fact, he identified Matt Wilson with the same language he used for Dave Evans. Dave Evans gets indicted. Matt Wilson, fortunately, escaped. On March 16th, she's shown this picture and says she's 100% sure this guy was the part. On April 4th, she's shown this picture again and says he was at the party, not the person who assaulted her, and he was standing outside talking to the other dancer. This is the only person she recognized in both the photo arrays and in the photo lineup. The problem is, he wasn't even at the party. He was in Raleigh, in another dorm, visiting his girlfriend. And they submitted affidavits in his Duke University reader so that they could verify that he wasn't even there. So the only person she identifies in both of these isn't even at the party. On April 4th, she's shown this picture of Chris Loftus. Says he's in the living room sitting down. And then she changes her mind to the master bedroom. In fact, what we know is that Chris Loftus was never at the party. He left at 11 o'clock before she even got there and was back in his dorm room. She's shown this picture in the photo array and says she's 100% certain he was at the party. But then when she's shown this picture again, she didn't recognize him. So she goes from 100% to not recognized. On March 16th, she's shown this picture. Again, 100% certain being at the party. And she's shown this picture again on April 4th, and he's not smiling anymore. She can't recognize him. On March 16th, 100% sure again. On April 4th, she doesn't recognize. You know, one of the narratives that's kind of emerged in this case is people keep talking about, well, this was never. You never made any of these kids didn't do it. You know, it's amazing how many people walk up to me on the street and say, I always knew there was something wrong with that. And so the narrative that comes out is the justice system worked. You know, we're not going to convict them. That these kids had good lawyers, the system worked the way it is, and kind of a get-over-it sense. But what I really want to leave you with is this thought about how close this was to going terribly wrong. I will tell you, having been through and litigating this case, that you don't have to change much to change this result completely. And let me give you three examples. Alan Gell was sentenced to death in February of 1997. There's a fingernail in an obsession and a single oath. We talk about each of those three facts, how they affect this case. Now, of course, many of you are saying, what the hell does this have to do with the Brady 9 years later? Well, Alan Gell was a final. He was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. His death sentence was affirmed in February 1997. And that becomes important because in North Carolina at that time, you were not permitted to look at the files of a prosecutor unless you had been sentenced to death. If you'd been sentenced to life in prison without parole, when his family came to me, we never would have been able to see the prosecutor's files. But because he was on death row, because he was lucky enough to be sentenced to death, we got a chance to look at his files. And in Alan's case, what we found was very interesting. Alan was accused of killing a man named Alan Ray Jenkins, whose body was found in his home on April 14, 1995. Now, Alan was actually in jail from April 4th through April 14, 1995. Kind of what we call an airtight alibi for that period. So the state's theory, naturally enough, through two co-defendants who had taken very generous plea offers, was that the victim had been killed on April 3, and we just didn't find his body until April 14. Which meant that when I looked at the case, it was a very easy case. If the victim doesn't die on April 3, 1995, then Alan Gell is a missing man. It's as simple as that. That guy's alive after April 3rd. Alan can't kill him because he's in jail. Well, Because Alan was sentenced to death, we got a chance to look through the state's files, and what we found is that there were a total, including the victims of his brother, his lifelong friends, and his neighbors, of 17 people. It's all along that route. They had him alive right up through April 10th. He was walking around. He was ordering food. Waitresses were waiting on him. His neighbors were talking to him. He was talking to people about fixing his roof. And none of those statements, none, were ever supplied to the defense. So when we got those statements, we filed them with the court, and we had a new trial for Alan. And it received a lot of publicity, and after a retrial, ironically enough, led by the same prosecutors who then investigated the Duke case, the special prosecutors, a jury acquitted right away, took one vote, and everyone believed he was innocent. The General Assembly was so outraged about that case that what they did is they mandated by statute open file discovery. So now in North Carolina, in felony criminal cases, the prosecutor is required to give defense attorneys everything that's in his or her file. And if it wasn't for that law, we'd be in the middle of a jury trial in Durham right now on these rape charges. Because there is no way Mr. Nikon would have given us evidence showing our clients were innocent. He tried to suppress it as it was. There's no way he would have shared the weaknesses in his file. And if it wasn't for that law, these young men would have been at risk for going to jail for 30 years. And I don't mean 30 years and you do too. I mean 30 years and you're going to do every single day. If it wasn't for Alan Gell being sentenced to death in February 1997. The next one is a fingernail and an obsession. We'll talk about the fingernail first. This is all the physical evidence that wasn't there. No hairs, no fibers, no fingerprints, nothing that could have put Reed Seligman or Colin Finity in that bathroom. They didn't live in the house. There was no evidence they were ever in that bathroom where Ms. Mangan says the rape occurred. In fact, there was no evidence of any rape in that bathroom or any physical injuries to her. But what there was were some fingernails. These were false fingernails. Here are the pictures of them. And some of them were unapplied and others had been applied. The ones up here had been applied because they had some nail polish on them. And they didn't split in half the DNA test. And Mr. Nifong was obsessed with the fingernails. And he was obsessed with the fingernails for this reason. These fingernails were found in a wastebasket in Dave Evans' bag. Now, we talked a little bit about how easily DNA is transferred. Mr. Nifong was convinced he would find Dave Evans' DNA on those fingernails. He sent them to the State Bureau of Investigation. They couldn't find it. All they could say is, we've got three unidentified DNA on these fingernails. So then he hired a private lab, the lab that found all the other unidentified DNA. In fact, if it wasn't for hiring a private lab to look at the fingernails, we never would have found the other unidentified DNA. Now, Ms. Mangan, the ironic part about it is Ms. Mangan claimed to the police 2 days later, see, I don't have my fingernails. That's because they tore them off during the struggle. Well, the DNA analysis, as I said, showed that her DNA was on them. There were three males. And the private lab found there was one male. And they could not exclude Dave Evans. They couldn't identify the other two, but they could exclude him. But they couldn't exclude one of the male profiles. It was a partial profile as being Dave Evans. They also couldn't exclude any people in their own DNA database. There was a comparison. And none of them were Seligman, Finity, or LaCrosse. And that's the bathroom that they found. The ironic part is, if he hadn't been so obsessed with the fingernails, he never would have sent this to the private lab. If the private lab hadn't gotten it, they never would have tested the other items and gotten this part of the DNA from them. The if they hadn't gotten those partial DNA profiles, we don't have a hearing in which the whole thing comes apart. I don't know how many of you remember this or followed it, but on December 15th of last year, we had a hearing in this case. We thought it was a scheduling hearing. A scheduling hearing is you show up with the judge and say, we've got these motions that need to be scheduled, and let's all agree on a time when we can schedule. So we didn't think anything was going to happen. Brad Band had gone through and found this unidentified DNA, and he filed a motion to compel it, saying, we've got an unidentified DNA here. It's not in the report. Can you tell us what's going on? Mr. Nyquam showed up in court that morning with his DNA. Now, some of you are going to have to cross-examine people when you move out of your careers. And I don't recommend cross-examining DNA experts without preparation. But we had no preparation, because we didn't know it was going to be there. Mr. Nyquam hadn't told us. And so we had to make a quick decision. Are we going to cross-examine this guy, or are we going to have to back off? And the entire media is there. There must have been 50 reporters in the courtroom. There were cameras and still photographers all over the place. And we knew if we backed down, Mr. Nyquam would have stood up and made fun of us and told the whole world we're asking for things that we don't want. So Joe Cheshire, who was kind of our team leader, made a decision. He said, we're going to cross-examine this guy, and Brad, you're going to start, and Jim, you get to finish. And of course, Joe wasn't anywhere in that chain. And Brad did a magnificent job. I mean, we were hitting this guy cold. And by the time we got done with him on cross, he had admitted he had purposely not put the unidentified DNA in his report. That report had violated his own laboratory protocol. And that he had done that as part of a deliberate agreement with Nyquam not to put the unidentified male DNA in that report. And at that point, the entire case came apart. And the only reason Mr. Nyquam sent those fingernails to the private lab is because he hated Joe Cheshire's guts. And once Joe Cheshire showed up and started opposing him, he was bound and determined the day that evidence was going to be cut. I was going to do anything he could to indict him, which is why he became obsessed with the fingernails, which ultimately led to his disbarment. The ironic part about it is, these are pictures from the party, Miss Mangum had already lost her fingernails before she was dancing. You can see that from these pictures. It was simply another lie that she had told. But he so wanted to believe it, it led to his undoing. And again, if he doesn't care about that fingernail, this stuff never gets to that private lab. If it never gets to that private lab, this case never falls apart, and we're in the middle of a trial. Let me talk about the final one. It's a single vote. In March, when Mr. Nyquam went on his public relations offensive, Joe wrote him a letter and said, you're violating the canons of ethics. Got to stop. We can talk about this. You need to share evidence that you stop going out the press. Mr. Nyquam's response was he gave an interview on, I think it was MSNBC, in which he demonstrated the chokehold that Ms. Mangum said was used. In other words, he went even more over the top. So at that point, Joe filed a complaint with the State Bar. The State Bar investigated it through the summer. And the North Carolina State Bar has never intervened in an ongoing case, and with good reason. You don't want people to use ethics complaints as a weapon to change counsel on the other side. But after the December 15th hearing, when it came out that there had been a conspiracy to obstruct justice, essentially, the State Bar met in an emergency session of the Ethics Committee. There were 16 people on that committee. And the question was, are we going to go forward now in the middle of this case, or are we going to wait until the case is over? Because the plan had always been, we'll file charges when the case is over. And it was a contentious debate. I think there are good arguments either way. And at the end of the debate, the vote was 8-8, evenly split. And the chairman, a lawyer named Jim Fox, cast the deciding vote. And he voted in favor of instituting proceedings now, while the case is ongoing. And that, single vote, gave these kids their lives back. Because when they filed these charges, Mr. Nikon had to withdraw. He had a conflict of interest that couldn't be resolved. That put the case in the laps of the special prosecutors. We knew at that point that we were dealing with honest and fair prosecutors, and that if we could give them the evidence, not only would they dismiss the charges, but they might even give these kids their lives back. If that single vote goes the other way, we would have gotten these charges dismissed. We would have won our motion to suppress. We would have stopped her from identifying these kids in court, and for the rest of their lives, this case would have followed. And people would have said it was dismissed on a technicality, and because they were rich and they had good lawyers, and these kids would have lived under this shadow until they died. And the only way they got their lives back was when the Attorney General stood up and said, they are innocent. And that only happened because of a single vote. This is a picture of a protest that took place in Durham, North Carolina at the end of March. People are marching down the street carrying a banner demanding that my client be castrated. This took place in the United States of America in the 21st century. No one had been charged with anything at that point. If you remember nothing else about this case, remember this picture. Because if it can happen to these kids, I guarantee you, and I have seen it, it happens a lot. It happens to people of color. It happens to the poor. It happens across the country. And the narrative about this case has to be, you have got to fight for justice minute by minute sometimes, and certainly motion by motion. Because there are a lot of people of color and there are a lot of poor people who were in jail who didn't have attorneys to sift through the evidence and who were convicted on weaker evidence and lying witnesses and witnesses that made deals with the prosecutor and the prosecutor didn't care. And the story of this case can't be about, well, you get good lawyers, you can get off from anything. The story has got to be about, we need to do a heck of a lot better. We need to get it right. And we're not getting it right. This was just one example. So remember that picture. And when you go out and you start dealing with the presumption of innocence, and some of you are going to be prosecutors, or United States attorneys, or judges, remember this case and what it really stands for, and the justice that you've got to fight for on a daily basis in order for the system to get it right. Thank you very much.